Right, Sabrina George talking to Nick Wilty, part three on for New Comedy Radio. Right, next question I want to ask you is about writing for other people. Do you write for other people?
I have done in the past, and I involuntarily do now. Do you know what I mean? Where some people take me act and don't pay me for it.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, I'll map it and name names, but I'm not going to get myself in a legal argument.
But why? So why don't you do it now?
I find, and I've spoken to a lot of top comedians about this, if you think something really funny, you don't want to give it away.
Right.
You really don't. I used to write for Smith & Jones and for a little while for Rory Bremner. And when I first started in Canada, there was a really good guy out there called Ian Bagg. He's based in New York. He's a Canadian guy. Really, really good guy. And he bought some lines off me. And we started at the same time. We're both newcomers. And he went, "You're going back to England. Can I use that line you wrote about such and such, a Canadian thing?" And I went, "Yeah." He said, "I'll pay you for it." And he paid me like $50 a line or something. To my deep shame, if you like, I didn't keep to that bargain. I got back to England and mentioned that I'd lived in Canada, and it became part of my routine for many years. Years later, I was in New York City doing a show in the comic strip, and Ian Bagg was in the audience. I didn't know that, and I did this joke. I said, "I originally started my career in Canada. I don't know if you know Canada." And I started talking, and I did a joke that I'd written 10 years before. And Ian came up after me and said, "Hey, Nick, how you doing?" I went, "Ian, oh my God." He went, "Yeah. Man, I bought that line off you. I've been using that line for 10 years. I went, and I covered my tracks. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you remember me, so I thought I'd do it to remind you." I said, "No, I don't do it either. And of course, I've never done it since." But so there's a certain moral code. But that's a nice routine that I wrote, really nice routine. But I sold it to him for $150, basically. So years later, you know, I'm writing for Smith & Jones, and I would write stuff that they would use in their TV shows. They didn't use an awful lot of my stuff, but occasionally they would. They'd pay me for it. And I think, oh, I don't know. It's gone now. It's been on telly. I can never, even though I wrote it, I can never use it again because it's been on telly. And I wish I kept it, because if you write a good joke, and providing you don't do it on a TV or radio show, that can stay in your set forevermore if it's non-topical, specific, non-specific about a certain event. And I find that's true for me. I have been asked to write for people. In fact, quite recently I was asked to write for Shazia Mirza. But I can't give away my best lines to people. Certainly not if they're going to do them on TV. And I think, I mean, I sort of, there's a dichotomy here, and I'll tell you what it is, and that is if you get famous quickly, you run out of material. I mean, I was lucky to run into Jasper Carrot years ago. I was doing a show in Birmingham and he was in the audience. And he couldn't have been nicer to me. He was absolutely fabulous. And he said to me, "Do you write all your own stuff?" I went, "Yeah." He went, "That is fantastic. Absolutely brilliant." He said, "How much have you got?" I said, "I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours or something, you know, whatever." I'd been going a few years. And he said, "Oh, that is brilliant." He said, because I had the same thing. He said, and then I got my own TV show. He said, and everything I'd ever written was gone in 6 weeks like that. He said, then I go on tour, I can't do all my best jokes are all gone. They're out in the ether somewhere, you know. He said, so I'm just warning you now, mate. He said, I know you've got this thing about people nicking your material and all that. He said, but if you ever get famous and you get on TV, you're going to need writers. And I went, no, I disagree with you totally. Well, I've never been in that position, so I don't know. But every time I do TV, I do my own stuff. But I can see his point.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think it's what a lot of acts.
Oh, absolutely.
From.
I don't think there's any shame in it. I mean, I know.
No, it's just I think why some acts don't come across as well on TV as they do in their live show, where they are using their own material, because yeah. There's something slightly other about other people writing them. It doesn't mean it's less good. It's not so them.
Yeah, it's it's not you. And I mean, particularly with someone like me, you know, bases my whole act on my life. If I had writers, what if they wrote me some joke about somewhere I haven't been? They've written some fabulous joke about I was in Libya, right? Now, I've never been there, and it's a brilliant joke. I couldn't do that, you know. So, yeah, as you know, I travel a bit. I was in Libya last week. Anyway, I'm doing it. It just sucks some of your soul out of you, doesn't it? And I see that in other people that are really good acts that have got writers in, that it's just... It's not quite there, is it? You know.
And I think audiences don't know why, but they're often say, "Oh, you know," because you rave on about some act, and then they're on telly, and they go, "I don't know," and you go, "Yeah, but it isn't them really on telly."
Well, also, I mean, I won't name names here, but some people don't look good on telly, full stop.
Yeah.
I mean, I call it the Bob Monkhouse syndrome, I never met Bob Monkhouse, but people who met him said he was the most charming, lovely man, and he'd got more material than the whole comedy circuit put together. He was not short of material. But he came over on telly as this smarmy, self-satisfied,
slightly
oily...
greasy,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yet in real life, apparently, I know friends, Kevin McCarthy, he's a good friend of mine. Now, he was a great friend of Bob Monkhouse, and said he was the most down-to-earth, lovely, charming bloke. You know, he had a way with women. He was, dedicated to comedy. But he just comes across that. And now I can think of a couple of comics from our generation, if you like, people on the circuit now, that have had many a break on TV, and their agents keep pushing, and they get all the breaks on some, but the public go,
it's
just not there. Mm. And I'd even include myself in that number. I've had a number of breaks on TV where I've been on high-profile shows, BBC One, Channel 4, you know. You pick a time slot, I've tried it, you know, 8 o'clock Saturday night, you think, if that doesn't get you noticed, nothing will. But my style of comedy has to be, you know, reined in a little bit. I'm not allowed to do what I would like to do, the swearing, the sex, the drug references. So I have to sort of edit it and make it palatable to the masses. And I don't come across the way I see myself or the way I'm perceived by a club audience. And now that's true for so many acts. And there are other acts that come across exactly as they are. Joe Brand is a prime example. Joe Brand is exactly herself on stage. Or I know her well enough to know that that's not an awful exaggeration to say. She is the person you see. Jack D, although he's not as grumpy in real life, he's basically a downbeat person. He's somebody whose humour comes from being oppressed, even though, you know, he's very successful. And it rings true. You can imagine him losing his temper at the pettiness of labels in the supermarket or something. Other acts, we just don't believe them. It just doesn't ring true.
Yeah.
And that includes some of the best live acts you can see.
And why do you think believability is an important thing in comedy? Why do you think that an audience has to believe, however ridiculous? I mean, Ross Noble talks about wizards and lizards and dragons and whatever, and there's something the audience will always somehow go with it.
Well, do you know, that's a fun example to use, but there's always been comics that talk about surreal things that get away with it. It's because we want to believe that they really are that weird. You know, you wouldn't want to know that Ross is teetotal and lives on a farm in Australia with a beautiful wife and doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't take drugs. You want him to be this sort of weirdo that you can imagine him being the nutter on the bus. And of course, he's not in real life. He's an absolutely charming, lovely bloke, and he lives a very, very nice, conventional life, you know. Now, if you get someone, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Say Billy Connolly in his prime, say, in the 70s and 80s, you'd believe every word he said. When he said, I was at a party the other night, he said, and, you know, we're on our fifth bottle of rum, and, you know, and something happened, and you'd go, we can imagine that happening. Now, the reason I believe that...
Sorry, mate.
It could have been an act. That was a beggar, in case you're wondering. Pointing at a microphone is going to stop him. It seemed to work, didn't it? That's the way to get rid of beggars, just get our microphone. We're making a documentary about people, and then, boom, she's gone.
And it's not you, bless him.
And it's not you. No, going back to...
Yes,
things like, now, I believe that the audience, they suspend their belief. They know, in their heart of hearts, so you can't say, I was on my way here tonight and something happened, you know, or you know what it's like, I was on the night bus last night, da, da, da. They know that isn't strictly true. But they suspend their belief. They want to suspend their belief. That's part of it. We are an act, after all. Mm. You know, and I mean, I've been picked up by my family for this, where I've been on stage and I'd say something like, I was in Amsterdam last weekend, and one of my brothers-in-law said, Nick, that was like 6 weeks ago. And I go, yeah, I know, but for comedy purposes, I was there last week, right? And I'll do the same joke. It doesn't matter to the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just to keep the whole thing flowing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I finished with the girl in Amsterdam in March, but the jokes are fantastic about her. She's happy when we're doing them, and we're still good friends. So I still say, I was in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago. My girlfriend's bisexual, by the way, because the joke is valid. Now, it would be equally valid to say, I split up with her in March, so this happened in March.
It doesn't really
but
matter.
The audience, yeah. The audience don't want that, yeah. Because it gives a precise date and time to a joke, which they don't want.
Yeah.
You know?
I was thinking more about the general persona, because my show last year was called Crime Comedy. I mean, I was doing stuff about scams I'd done and smuggling. And you know, identity fraud, credit card fraud, you know, all those sort of
which
things.
Is ironic because Aaron, Benny Aaron was up doing the show, I bet somebody had stolen his identity.
Exactly, he came to see my show and sat grumpily in the whole show. Looking, but it was really interesting because some people fed back and said, God, you've done a lot of research.
Yeah.
And then other people would go, that's amazing, blah, blah, blah. And I even did a whole section where I was actually stealing someone's identity in the audience. And that always worked incredibly. It worked 100% of the time. And
wow.
Yeah, and it was sort of proof to the audience and to me that if you were middle class and you look someone dead in the eye and you say, this is what you are and this is what I'm going to ask you, you will always get what you want out of it. And it doesn't matter how much we spend on ID cards or all this rubbish that's going on at the moment, you can actually work your way around a scam. Yeah. And this was part of the... was in the show and was going to happen. And I thought that piece alone would stand up, that people would say, no, she doesn't know what she's doing. This isn't completely made up. But some people, not all of them, I would say about 40%, would come back and say, God, you've done your research well, or that didn't really happen. And I thought that was the whole point. It's because I'm white, middle class, people don't believe I could.
See, I've got an opposite problem. That is because I'm working class.
Yeah.
I own a yacht, right? I bought a yacht when I was on TV years ago, right? I've tried it in my act. No one believes me. And I had, you know, if I'll give an example, 10 years ago, right, I bought a yacht. I got a 32-foot sailboat. I lived on it. My girlfriend was absolutely gorgeous. She directed for the National Theatre. She was Israeli. She was stunning, intelligent, beautiful woman. No one believed. I'd say my girlfriend, she's a Jewish girl, she's called Ori. And why do you come out of all that rubbish like that? Like, I'm on my boat with my girlfriend who's Israeli film director. Well, because she is. Yeah, I could say, my girlfriend works in Tesco's, behind the counter, it's called Sharon, people just immediately, don't matter how outrageous the story is, they go, that's probably true, that is.
Now, why is that? And how because, do you get over it? Why is
well,
that?
Well, sometimes you have to play up to stereotypes. I'm perceived as being working class, therefore I'm a bit thick, right? I'm perceived as that. So I can get away with stuff that you probably couldn't in your accent.
Exactly.
The misunderstandings that we all have, right? I can get away with it. But hopefully they see through that. And occasionally I'll get reviews and things that reflect that they can see through the, sort of what they call the Jack the Lad exterior or whatever, and go, well, actually underneath, this bloke, you know, I'm not intellectual by any stretch, but I'm not a ficko. You know, you can't be in this business. You cannot be in this business if you can't think on your feet. So what I get is people believe the most ridiculous things and don't believe the bits that are absolutely fundamental to me. I mean, I've just been working on cruise ships, right, and at the moment, I've got a busted leg, I'm walking on a stick, right? So I have a lot of trouble getting on and off stage. Now, people quite often come up to me after the show on these cruise ships and say, oh, it's not a prop then. Why would I have a prop of a metal cane and a limp? Do you think that's going to help my act look better? Do you think that's going to help me ball girls? Or why would you make up something like that? And they go, oh, and I thought it was part of your act. And they don't see that something that's very blatantly true, the fact that I'm limping around the deck. Well, I'm going to do that all week long just waiting for this show because I've got one line about having a broken leg, you know. And then they don't believe the bits that are true, and then they do believe the bits that aren't, you know. So I say, you know, in this particular show the other night, I said, by the way, you know, we've just been in Ville, France. I said, I used to work there, and there's a big villa there owned by David Niven. I helped build the driveway 20 years ago, right, when I was a builder, right? And I'd tell a little story about it, and because we've been in Villefranche today, I'll say, do you know the villa on the corner, it's called Cancer and Delamar, I've got all the details, and I've got a funny little line about it, and then people come up to me afterwards and they say, so what, you saw that villa and thought, oh, I'll make up a story about it again. No, I worked there 20 years ago, I built the driveway from David Niven's widow, right, it was her mansion, and they don't believe it. And yet they believe something stupid, like I say, oh, I went ashore today. You won't believe who I ran into, Jeremy Beadle. And people say, what, you actually ran into him on the street? And you go, oh, no. You know, so... sometimes I'm exasperated by that.
But it is a fascinating thing, again, talking about truth or lies or whatever it is, because you can make something up, and as long as it sticks within your persona, which is something, again, is hard... It, to me, in the beginning, it was the hard thing to find what it was that the audience saw in me. And then once I found it, and then I could write stuff and I go, no, that might be true, but it's not going to come from my mouth.
Well, I take advice off comics that I respect. And when I first started, a couple of people said things to me that influenced my act. I was talking to Jeff Green once, and he said to me, he said, you know, don't mind me saying, he said, when you talk about girls, some of it sounds a bit sleazy coming from you. And I went, does it really? And he went, yeah, it does. He said, because you've got that look about you. And I went, right. What? So even when I'm telling a nice story about me and my girlfriend in the theatre, it's kind of, he went, yeah. Yeah, he can do it. He's a charmer, he's a good-looking man. When he says, yeah, me and my girlfriend were doing this the other day, and people go, oh, yeah, that's probably true. When I do it, they go, yeah, right. Yeah, like you and your girlfriend have got a villa in France, and we did it at the time, you know. It doesn't ring true to them. So after a while, I realised that, and a couple of people mentioned things. I mean, I didn't used to take the mic off a stand, and they said, when you don't take the mic off a stand, it makes you aloof, it makes you, you can't connect with the audience. And I went, does it really? Oh, well, I'll take it off a stand, and suddenly, you know, now I'm perceived more of a Jack Ladd man of the people because I take the mic off a stand, and I'll talk to people in the audience, or I'll go over and tap somebody on the shoulder, because I can now, the microphone's off a stand. Now, I didn't see that until it was pointed out to me. And then you realise after a while you're perceived a certain way. Mm. You know, I mean, I'm a man of a certain age, for instance. I've always been an older person on the circuit. I didn't start till I was 31. So, you know, work it out yourself. I was never a young comedian. I never was. So I can't get away with things that people, even people my age that have been doing it for years, can get away with because they've been around a long time. They say, oh, I remember I was at university. I did that. Well, I never went to university. And for me to pretend I did would be such a leap of the imagination. I'd have to get all my facts right away, and it's too much hard work. So I don't do it. I'm quite happy for people to think that I'm this sort of thick working class bloke that's struck lucky every now and again. You know, that somehow I managed to get girlfriends, and I seem to have had lots of exotic holidays. Oh, I must have worked on, you know, I must have been deckhand on the boat. Well, funny enough, I was. But, you know, I've realised after a while that if you play up to the perception of people, you're actually funnier in a way. You know, I mean, you know, Jo Brand's a good example. She's not a man-hater in any respect. She's married with children, but she's still perceived as this, you know, some people even think she's a lesbian. You know, yeah, but she's got two kids and a husband. Yeah, but look at her. And you go, well, that's... But so she's played up to that for humour purposes most of her comedy career. It doesn't matter after a while. It's all, you know, Jack D's not as grumpy as he seems, and he's married with lots of children and a lovely big house, but his comedy wouldn't work if he said, do you know what, I'm so lucky in life, I've got these four lovely children and a beautiful house, and the other day I was thinking how lucky I was in my Porsche, and people go, no, that's not the Jack D we know, we want you to whinge about something, you know,
we want someone who goes to Tesco's and complains about crucifix or whatever.
You've got it, you know. So in a way, to have a successful career, you've got to do it. And I mean, the analogy I would give, and you know, I mean, I'm going to brag a little bit here, one of my friends is quite a well known pop star. Now, he has to do old material. When he does a concert, he might have a couple of thousand people. They want him to do his greatest hits. Now, he's fed up with that, but the moment he does new stuff, people switch off. Now, in comedy, we get the absolute opposite. If I turned up at a show tonight, and there's 200 people there that know my stuff and that think I'm a really good act, they want me to talk new stuff. They do not want to hear stuff that I've done before. So we didn't have an argument, but we're on our way to Glastonbury, and he's Winnebago once, and he said to me, he said, are you going to do your greatest hits tonight? I went, I can't. He said, I love all that new stuff you got. He was with me in Indonesia. We did a benefit together over there after the tsunami. And he said, you can do all your new stuff. I said, well, I've got to for a start, you know. And besides which, if I went out and did my greatest hits, you know, 1,000 of these 2,000 people see me every year. It's the same audience that sit in that comedy tent in Glastonbury. I would die on my arse. And he said, oh, I wish it was like that for me. He's got a brand new album. He'd love to go out and do 12 tracks off his latest album. But people will shout out requests. They want old stuff. And he's got a perception of a certain person. I'm not going to name him because he doesn't know I'm doing this. But, you know, he's a well-known person, and he gets people come up, and all they want to talk about is stuff that he did in the 90s, you know, and it's, he wants to move on, they won't let him go, so he has to play up to that. He goes on to basically sells himself on, yeah, you're going to get greatest hits, you know. You're pigeonholed by the audience, not by yourself, and that's the unfortunate thing. I would love to be perceived as a sexy old bloke, but I'm not, so I have to, do you know what I mean? I have to play up to what I've got. I'm this working class a week who's done a bit of travelling, you know.
Behind the scenes, you're a sexy bloke, yeah.
Behind the scenes, I'm, yeah, just not on stage, you know. And you, when you realise that, then you play up to your strengths. And I, you know, I've got a successful career. I can't argue with that. I get work all around the world. So whatever I'm doing is working. So in a way, don't change the formula. I would much rather be regarded as a different person. I wish people would think of me as someone who's quite clever, but I'm not. I don't get regarded as that.
But do you think people who are quite clever, I mean, I'm just thinking of an immediate answer to my own question, Peter Cook, but a lot of people who are that clever are not very universally funny. I mean, Peter Cook had a fanatical following, and I think he's tremendous.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't know whether he could have done the touring around the world, different clubs, different audiences.
Well, it's horses for courses, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, look, one of the most phenomenally successful people in this country is Peter Kay. Would that work in Australia? Probably not. Do you know what I mean? It's very homegrown. It's very about
his family,
a certain
his life,
type of people
Bolton.
In Bolton. Yeah. Certain, you know, bingo and hot scones would not work in Australia, for instance. Mm. Whereas my act, I won't say it's universal, but it tends to work all around the world because it's about the type of person I am, which is an internationally travelled person. So I can get away with stuff in certain countries. Billy Connolly, as we know, does very well in Australia. Ross Noble does very well there. Eddie Izzard does very well in America. It's not fair to name names of people who haven't done well, but I can think of some fabulous acts that haven't gone well. I've done Shanghai 4 or 5 times, and I've done, you know, Beijing and all sorts of places in obscure parts of the world with very well-known acts that are very good, and they haven't gone that well because people can't relate to that sort of persona, that sort of person. You know, I mean, I'm lucky that I'm sort of like a super backpacker. People trust me and believe me when I say, oh, last time I was here, I lived in Chungking Mansions or something. They go, oh, right, you probably did. You know, when I was here the first time, I was a shark fisherman. And they go, oh, right, yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, yeah. Yeah,
Whereas,
like I said, Peter Kay's a good example. We imagine him in Australia saying, yeah, so anyway, in Bolton we do this. And do you remember Jamboree bags? And then they go, no, mate, no, I haven't got a clue what you're on about. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I'm not saying he couldn't adapt or get writers in.
Sure.
Or borrow it from somewhere that could do that for him. But, yeah, you are pigeonholed, you know.
But then I think it depends what sort of career you want, because I think some comics do, like you, are really happy to travel in all its senses, and other people are really happy to build up a massive following in just England, not even Scotland.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ross Noble's a good friend of mine, and I stayed on his farm in Australia last year, and we had a good chat about this. He's a phenomenal act, and he's very, very successful here and in Australia. I don't know if he's cracked America yet, but that may well happen. But he's got a global perspective on his career, and he knows where he wants to be. I don't, and never have done. If I earn double what I'm earning now, I would cut down and do half as many gigs. That's what I'd do. I'd have more holidays. I love being on stage, but it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not how I define myself. I don't have plans in that league. You know, I mean, I'm writing a book about the Falklands at the moment. I want it to get published, and I hope that that leads to me getting more people want to come and see me full, so I can then do art theatres and whatever. But the worst thing could happen to me is to become famous visually. I don't want to be famous visually, and that's something that I've been fighting. And it's no big deal because I've had sort of semi-famous times in my life where I was on telly, and I don't like it. I don't like being in the public domain. It's not my cup of tea. I'm a private person who likes to have an amazing life, and you can't have that amazing life wherever you go, people keep tapping you on the shoulder, quoting your own material, telling you why they love you or hate you. I really don't need that. So, you know, you get to the level of someone like Frank Skinner, Jack D. Lee Evans. They couldn't be sat here like we are now having a nice chat and a glass of wine on the South Bank, because people come up, hey, how you doing?
Well, tap we did have a shoulder.
We had a beggar, yeah, who may well have recognised me. Can I tell you a quick story? There used to be a statue of Nelson Mandela up there, and when I was sleeping rough, the day that was unveiled, when they unveiled it, I was under the canvas.
Yeah.
When they unveiled the top one, I was sleeping rough there. It was a weird time in my life. I'd come back from my travels, and before I did comedy, and I was just sleeping rough for the fun of it. I had family to go to, but I was just a drinker, and I preferred being on the street than going home, you know.